Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AgEM podcast. I'm your host, Belle Cheeves, and I'm here with Dr. Annika Schmieding, cultural anthropologist and senior researcher at the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences and a lecturer at the University of Amsterdam. We'll be discussing her first book, Sufi Civilities, Religious Authority and Political Change in Afghanistan, which just came out in 2024 and recently won the Nikki Keddie Book Award. Congratulations to you, Annika, on this really extraordinary book and the accolades it is already rightfully receiving.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me here today.
A pleasure, truly. Sufi Civilities is, as I said, really just a remarkable work of anthropology, examining how urban Sufi communities in Afghanistan deal with violence and transition, both within larger social and political contexts, and also in terms of leadership and tensions and ambiguities within the groups themselves. To me, as a historian, Sufi Civilities is also a stunning history, really, of a time so recent, but which, due to the political shifts since August of 2021, feels so far away, as you heartbreakingly describe in your conclusion. You beautifully weave in threads of more distant pasts that remain ever present across the Persianate world, such as the importance of poetry, and you so effectively show how threads from Afghanistan's history shape the experiences and practices of Sufi communities in the present. In your first chapter, you outline threads of resistance, relationships to the state, and distance from it. And through each thread, you also show how Sufi individuals and groups have adapted, or the term you use is adaptational dexterity, which I love, as opposed to remaining resilient or unchanged over time. Much like you do in the book with your first chapter, I'd like to start here. Can you set the stage for our listeners? What brought you to this project, and what are some of these important historical and perhaps scholarly contexts that ground your ethnographic work?
Yes, thank you so much again for having me here today. I was working and researching in Afghanistan in the mid-2000s, in the 2010s, initially actually not on Sufism, but on political representation of minority groups. And as I was learning more about Afghanistan's complex history, I wondered more also about religious and cultural aspects that had shaped this history. And for example, when I was learning Persian in Iran at Mashhad Ferdowsi University, I was also reading and translating texts by Maulana Balkhi, commonly in the West known as Rumi. And I was wondering what actually had happened to the keepers of this knowledge. So to the people who are on this living path of knowledge, these different Sufi groups. And when I talk to Afghan friends, I ask them about people whom they might know, who are teaching poetry or who are visiting Sufi lodges, the Khanakas. And I was referred to several teachers. Now, one of them, Ustad Haidari Wujudi, actually exemplifies for me a large chunk of this more recent history that you also alluded to. He has spent over 50 years in Kabul's public library, employed there as a clerk, but he was teaching Sufi poetry in weekly meetings. And 50 years in Afghanistan is an immense time. He saw the coup of 1978 and the Soviets rolling in to support the PDPA government that had taken over. And then there was, of course, the U.S.-backed Mujahideen, who started fighting the Soviets and the PDPA government in a proxy war during the Cold War era. He, of course, saw the withdrawal of the Soviets and the urban fighting that then started between the different Mujahideen factions. And he saw the rise of the first Taliban government and their fall after 2001. And so each government and fighting group brought with them different means of repression, dangers for people's lives in the fighting, but particularly for religious groups like Sufi circles also, they were targeted, their books were destroyed, their teachers put into prison or also killed. And so what I set out in this book is to document what happened to some of these groups, to tell Afghanistan's history from their vantage point.
And you do so beautifully, if I may say so. And I adored the story of Wujudi sitting in the library, you visiting there. Those stories were fantastic all throughout the book. Before we dive more deeply into some of the other ideas, it might be helpful to give some conceptual definitions for our listeners as well, especially as you present such nuanced understandings in the book itself. One of my favorite phrases that you write in describing Afghanistan's history as it relates to Islam and Sufism is tensions over the contours of belief. What are some of those contours of belief, and how are you and your interlocutors defining Sufism? Who gets to be a Sufi?
That is a very good question. I'm trying to say
a big one too. I know.
It's a very big question. I think Sufism itself is one of the most complex terms to describe.
Yes.
I always keep thinking of the late Shah Ab Ahmed, who remarked that the community of Islam is a community of disagreement over the question of what Islam is. And I would say by extension also what Sufism is. So I'm going to stay more closely to my interlocutors and who they understood to be a Sufi, or how they themselves understood their own path. And so my interlocutors understood being a Sufi as being a Muslim who seeks a personal encounter and closeness to God or to the divine. And this was also seen as an experiential path of learning. So many of my interlocutors became students or murids to a teacher from whom they would learn. Some of them would join meeting circles, halkas. Others would join ritual zikr circles at shrines, or they would go to Sufi lodges for classes or celebrations or for collective rituals. And I think what is difficult to define as what is actually Sufi is that they're not a consolidated group. They can be thought of, in at least in my understanding, as a spectrum of beliefs.
Yes, I love that.
And I think it mainly comes out for me as well, because I conducted research in different Sufi orders, for example, as well, among the Naqshbandiya, Qadiriyya, and former Chishti as well, who had different kinds of rituals and expressions of belief. For example, some would have zikr rituals with music, others without, or purely only with nadhani, singing and poetry recitations, so praise of the Prophet Muhammad. And some others would practice silently. So I met people who were on this path of learning, but also how they defined and saw what is a Sufi also varied in these different groups. And so the group of people also itself was pretty diverse.
And can you tell our listeners a bit more about the demographics of your interlocutors as well?
Yeah. So I think what is interesting about these different Sufi groups is that they stretch the whole socioeconomic and class gamut, so to speak.
Right.
So there were shopkeepers and cobblers, clerks and soldiers, so more working class people. There was also others who belonged to middle class brackets, such as imams or school teachers, university professors or students or government workers. And I also interviewed people who were from upper class elite levels. So of course there is the politically prominent Mujahideen and Gaylani families who were always in the political sphere as well and who had government offices. And so what is interesting about Sufi groups is that I found in them speakers of all different languages actually in Afghanistan and from different regions and from different urban and rural, as well as different class belonging. So it actually gives a really interesting microcosm of different spheres actually of Afghan society.
Right. I also found it fascinating to read about how even some members of the Taliban, at least that ruled between 95 and 2001, participated in Sufi rituals at times. Not so much the case anymore, but that was also very, very interesting. And thinking of your... Yes.
I think very, very much also not very well known outside of Afghanistan.
No.
I touch a little bit on that as well in the book in terms of beliefs and also how they might have shifted from the 90s until now, where we also see differences.
Yeah, that was a really fascinating aspect of the book as well. I also love how you wrote about your research and writing practices, and even relied on some of your interlocutors to give you input on the chapters. It sounded like just such a wonderfully collaborative and generative process, and also such a considerate one.
Thank you for saying that. I have to say, it's been a very interesting process of learning from different people whom also showed back some of the writing. But of course, I also don't want to gloss over that that also comes with difficulty. So a lot of the research mm-hmm. that I did, of course, was in Sufi communities that were in transition. So there was transitions right. of leadership and changes that were happening in the Sufi communities that I'm also describing in the book. And I have to say, I did this practice where I showed back certain chapters or parts that I had written back to some of my interlocutors, but I, of course, mm-hmm. also chose whom I showed it to. So because there were, of course, also disagreements within the communities who also had different right. ideas about what was happening and how to portray that. So I would say that sometimes I'm wondering whether we should maybe write another book about the process of how we conduct the research and all the problems that also come with it. I mean, it's been a wonderful learning experience, but also not fully without problems either.
Please write that book and come back on the podcast to talk about it. I can't wait to read it, please. So the other word I think would be helpful to define is also in the title, civilities. Can you tell our listeners why you've chosen this term, civility, in this particular context?
Yeah, so civility is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek play. So yes. The term civil, of course, has roots and resonances in idea of civilization or colonial mm-hmm. civilizing missions that also echo partly in the post-9/11 development projects that tried to build up right. an English-speaking NGO scene that could help implement development and reconstruction projects of the international intervention in Afghanistan. And I found that Sufi communities actually offered an alternative civil sphere, playing here on the word civil in terms of the way how people interact with each other, but also a little bit of play on the Sufi adab. So in terms of like yes. how to be in the world. And so Afghanistan has a generally long story and tradition of informal civic engagement of people coming together to improve local infrastructure, to support people in need, to mediate disputes. And I found Sufis as part of this informal organizing sphere of religion-based civil groups. They were an aspect that was never acknowledged by any of the foreign development funders who did aspects of civil society in Afghanistan. They were not interfacing with Sufis on that. But Sufis were part of soup kitchens for the poor, and they offered right. long-distance travelers respite in Sufi lodges. They've always been mediating disputes as well in communities. And they were also part of the religious educational sphere and community projects, even of building infrastructure through pooling money together, for example. So my concept of civility is centered on these different aspects that Sufi leaders and students were engaged in.
Beautiful. So one of the things that I really appreciate about your book is that it addresses so many preconceived notions about Afghanistan and Islam that exist both broadly and in scholarship. I think you phrase it so well, to quote, "The book attempts to serve as a corrective to the simplistic narratives that haunt descriptions of religious communities and their leadership in Afghanistan." Although you write attempts, I would say it succeeds. And of course, it was such a pleasure to read, really. But one of these simplistic narratives that you note often arises in discussions of Afghanistan is that of women and their roles or lack thereof in religious spaces. You dedicate chapter 4 to a discussion of navigating gender through examining the Faizani Sufi community, which is notable for its inclusion of women, and particularly women as leaders within the community. Can you tell us more about this community and how they navigated gender?
So the Qadiriyya Sufi order of the Faizani, they trace their inclusion of women back to their founder, Allama Faizani, who was seen by many contemporaneously as a moral exemplar. So someone whose behavior and outlook students wanted to aspire to. He included his wife as well as other women in his teaching. And at the core of his teaching and also of the Faizani's understanding actually of the Sufi path lays an understanding that the striving on the Sufi way is non-gendered, because finding right. God is part of being human, not about being a man or being a woman.
Right.
And they argued that everyone actually has a soul or the ruh, and that everybody also has a heart or the qalb. And for Sufis, the heart is a training ground. It's a mirror that needs to be polished to reflect the beauty of the world and the divine light. And so for the Faizanis, women were equal to men who had hearts and could be trained to perceive the divine and to get closer to the divine. And they had a very strong ethos of including women, and that also was not only the women who said it, but this is actually something that particularly men in the community were telling me. And they were very strong right. allies as well to the other students, the female students, but also to the female teachers within the community.
Yeah, it was really incredible to read about them and the different practices and the training programs that they had. It was really, really well done. another particular element of your discussion of the Faizani Sufi community that I found especially intriguing was that the inclusion of women leaders moved beyond kinship connections, which often characterized leadership transitions in other Sufi groups throughout history. Those kinship connections were most frequently patrilineal and male-dominated, but you also note that the father-daughter relationship was important. And this father-daughter relationship comes to the fore with the figure you bookend Sufi civilities with, and who makes an appearance in several chapters as well, Asma Majur, a woman who seemed to somewhat follow in her father's footsteps in some regards, but also very much forged and continues to forge her own way in leading the Sufi community she's a part of, and very much adapting to the constantly shifting political landscape in Afghanistan. Can you tell our listeners about Asma and the kinship connections present in both the history and more recent events of her story?
Yeah. Asma was the daughter of Ustad Majur, who was an important teacher of Sufi poetry, particularly of Bir Dehlavi, who was very beloved in Afghanistan and also in the wider region, of course. He had particularly learned a lot from his own father, Kandi Agha, who was a Naqshbandiya Sufi, but who also was teaching poetry. And they were organizing these Sufi circles, particularly around Urs, the date of death of Bedel. And they were also publishing about Bedel's poetry. So I still met Ustad Majur before he passed away. And Asma was very much learning from her father about poetry. She initially was also, still is a poet in her own right. She's writing. And then got taught by her father and started to actually edit also her father's writing. And she inherited her father's oeuvre and kept publishing actually also. It's a big tradition as well of self-publishing among Sufi teachers to publish right. and then disseminate the books among followers and in libraries and in bookstores as well across Afghanistan. And she started more and more actually printing of the editing of her father's work after his passing. And she became also a Sufi teacher in her own right after he passed away, a position that was also contested, particularly also by kin relations, by also her uncle, who was also teaching. And there were quite a few tensions, to say the least, about who would be teaching and who would be taking on this mantle of Bedel Shinazi, of knowing and teaching actually Bedel. And she was part of that. But that father-daughter relationship was also crucial in teaching her and also positioning her as a knowledgeable teacher.
Right. So on the note of those tensions and digging a little deeper there, one of the things that really struck me as I was reading about Asma in your chapter on Sufi poetry as Islamic education and heritage, after having read about the Faizani Sufi community where women leaders were common, was that during the condolence speeches at Asma's father's funeral, even though it seemed that Asma was very much a leader, if not yet the definitive one, given these tensions with her uncle, she was not acknowledged as such. I'm curious if her role went unacknowledged outside of those more official speeches as well, and if the more prominent Sufi leaders recognized her position more privately or only after these beginning moments of transition, if at all.
It's a very good question.
Because
it's a complex one.
Yes, yes. I know, and it's stemming really more from my own curiosity as opposed to what is in the book. I was so curious. I was waiting for what I think, what was it, Wujidi? I was waiting for him to actually acknowledge her. I was like, oh, he's going to be the one to acknowledge her. And then he didn't either. And I was like, oh, I have to ask about this.
Yeah, it's true. So you put your finger onto something that is a complex question, because a lot of critique and posturing is very indirect. It's not that people always position themselves in speeches, or obviously they position themselves through going, for example, to the event of one teacher and not another. So they choose, I mean, it's like voting by feet. They basically go to a certain person having an event, for example. But also there would be indirect acknowledgement. So, for example, I was very much struck by talking with different musicians and other teachers as well, who on the one hand very much wanted to tell, like, oh, I'm not taking sides and not saying anything. And Hadidi Wujudi, of course, was one of them to not take sides, but to say there shouldn't actually be a dispute. This is disreputable. Actually, this is not good. Why is there even this fighting that's happening? Beda deserves better. And but then there were others who in private would actually praise Asma or insinuate that actually, for example, her gender didn't make any difference. So they would say things like, oh, if a lion is coming through the door, do you not ask whether it's female or male? You're afraid. So he's like,
oh, I loved that line.
Asma is a lion. So you shouldn't care whether she's a woman or a man. And I think that so much so as there is indirectness, there's also waiting to see how people over time and with the way that they actually lead in their scholarship and their knowledge and appreciation, because it's an experiential path that also necessitates people to show their connection to the poetry and to these insights. So it waits for them to position themselves before people make a decision, for example, to take sides.
Yeah, that was a really intriguing part of the chapter. And perhaps the funeral and commemoration speeches were not the place for commenting on these different tensions. But it was notable that the uncle and the son were mentioned, but she didn't seem to be. So continuing through the story of Asma and her efforts, we also see the importance of poetry in Sufism, as you've already mentioned with her involvement with Bidil, particularly the relationship of poetry to cultural heritage work in Afghanistan, and even through music, which I loved. One of the things that you note Asma and her family were known for is broadening the reception of poetry through music. I'd love for you to tell our listeners a bit more about this and the role of poetry that you describe more broadly.
I think poetry is so often, in the West at least, just thought of as a beautiful pastime or something nice to read.
Right.
Whereas in Afghanistan, it had such an important place in religious education. It used to be taught in madrasas alongside the Quran in poetry collections. It was part and parcel, actually, of an understanding as well of religion, of Islam.
Right.
And I think what is interesting about Asma and her family's approach to also popularizing one of the poets, Bedel, was the alliance with a very famous Afghan musician, Ustad Sarahang, who started adopting then verses of Bedel into the music that he played. And he was one of the first musicians who was allowed to play at Radio Afghanistan, Radio Kabul, live on air. And many Afghans know Bedel's verses as well through this music. So it's a country on the one hand that has a large number of people who are illiterate, who have not learned to read and write, but it's so many people who know poetry by heart. And of course, right, there's the learning of poetry, but there's also the learning of poetry as well through music, where it finds its ways into homes, through radios and cassettes, and through listening to it. Now, YouTube, of course, is ubiquitous. Yes. Everybody has Spotify, so everybody's, of course, listening to these songs. And it is one way how I think also some of these Sufi families have directly contributed to the popularization of these songs and this music.
Amazing. There's so much more I'd like to discuss, as this book is truly so rich. The role of revelatory dreams, the Sufi lodges that you've already mentioned as well, notions of distance and staying out of politics, or at least maintaining a working relationship with the political. But our listeners shall just have to read the whole thing, as I now turn to my final couple of questions. So you end Sufi Civilities with an incredibly powerful discussion of Afghanistan and these Sufi communities after the Taliban took over in August of 2021. You write particularly of transitions and a certain kind of hope. I quote, "A core aspect that comes out of the variety of ways leaders navigate the changing situation is their belief in a potential for an otherwise, for transformation and change." You continue, noting that this hope is, I quote, "far from being a fetishization of resilience, it acknowledges the challenging circumstances, as well as the capacity of the people who find themselves in these situations and their determination to go on. The lives and navigations of the people we have met in the pages of this book are ongoing, unfinished, and incomplete. But they point to the ability to adapt and, with these adaptations, to manifest hope for alternative futures." And your very final, very poignant sentence is a quote from Asma, where she tells you, "things change." Are you able to share with us if things have changed for these Sufi communities even further since Sufi Civilities was published? And I'd also love to know more about what your and your interlocutors' hopes for the future of their communities might be.
Writing in post-2021 is a complex endeavor. The situation is very difficult for a lot of the communities that I researched with for all of these years. And officially, Sufi lodges were closed by the Taliban. And also, even speaking about Sufism, for example, in public has been severely restricted by a new edict that came out, which says that only particular people who were actually designated so by the Taliban are allowed to even talk about Sufism in public or to the media. So that's just kind of the official, the public side of this. Of course, there is many cross-cutting aspects to current life in Afghanistan that affects any of the people that I researched with. Part of that, of course, is the state of the economy with the difficulty of making a living. Another one, of course, is the closure of schools for women and the curtailing of participation in public life. And of course, that also on a very intimate and direct way affects all of the communities that I researched with. They are, however, finding ways to keep teaching, to keep learning, and to also finding community with each other, even though that is not always in the same formal settings in which they did before. And I think what the example of Asma Majur actually points towards, which came from a discussion that I had with her when I returned in 22 for a short stint to visit the different interlocutors of mine. And at the time, she actually had made very strong decisions to stay in country. Decisions that also many other Sufis have made. They have, I mean, some have left, of course, to neighboring countries, but a lot of them also have stayed and are finding ways to deal with the situation as is. And she even went a step further. She bought land and has plans to actually root down much more strongly and to build up a cultural center. So when I asked about her with the restrictions that we're currently finding ourselves in, she said that anything in life is temporary. And this is, of course, what things change. But she might not see the change of the restrictions that are currently in place, but it's also not the main thing that she works towards. She works towards something that's much further. So her gaze is much further than to the current political scenario and is actually towards her community and the people who are surrounding her and for whom she wants to guide them in a certain direction. And I think that a lot of outside commentators have time and again said about Sufi communities that they're dwindling or they're going to vanish and they're going to not be able to sustain their lives anymore in Afghanistan. And I agree that it has become severely difficult actually for them to do so. But I think surveying the last decades before and how much Sufi communities have been able to sustain their lives in Afghanistan, it actually just tells me that we don't know yet how they're going to be weathering the current time, but they will do so. And I think that this is not the last time we've seen Sufis teaching in Afghanistan and learning and striving towards knowledge.
Beautifully put. The frame of adaptational dexterity that you have really, really does come through. It's really powerful. So one final question for you. There are so many takeaways from this book. There are so many incredible different aspects to it. But if our listeners and hopefully the future readers of your book were to take away one main thing from it, what would you hope that would be?
I hope it would be an appreciation for the beauty and nuances of a culture and society so rich, such as Afghanistan's, and hopefully the curiosity to ask more questions and to do more research and be interested and engaging. And I very much hope that a book such as this is just one part in a much larger conversation where we're going to see, hopefully in the future, more engaging in.
I hope so as well. Thank you so much for joining us, Annika. It has been such a pleasure discussing your work. And as I said, there is so much more we didn't get a chance to touch on. Sufi Civilities is an incredibly powerful book that anyone interested in Sufism, Islam, gender, Afghanistan, or even just the Middle East and Persianate world at all should read. And it is available wherever you get your books. Thank you.
Thank you so much.